This episode of the Ortho Bullets podcast will go over the topic of distal biceps avulsion from the shoulder and elbow section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. Distal biceps avulsions are injuries to the biceps tendon at the radial tuberosity insertion that generally occurs due to a sudden excessive eccentric contraction of the biceps brachii. Diagnosis can be made clinically in the setting of complete tears with a hook test. MRI studies can be used to discern between a complete tear and a partial tear. Treatment can be non-operative or operative depending on patient age, patient activity demands, chronicity of tear, and degree of tear. Now, let's get into the episode. With respect to epidemiology, as far as the incidence of distal biceps avulsion, these injuries are typically rare. However, know that distal biceps tendon rupture represents about 10% of biceps ruptures. As far as the demographics, ruptures tend to occur in the dominant elbow of 86% of patients, of men that is 93% of the time, in their 40s. As far as the anatomic location of distal biceps avulsions, know that you can have a complete distal biceps avulsion, partial distal biceps avulsion, as well as an intersubstance muscle transection. So in a partial distal biceps avulsion, know that partial distal biceps tendon tears occur primarily on the radial side of the tuberosity footprint. An intersubstance muscle transection is seen when a rope is wrapped around the arm, for example, in the setting of tug of war. Risk factors for distal biceps avulsions include anabolic steroids. Know that smokers have a 7.5 times greater risk than non-smokers. Other risk factors include hypovascularity, intrinsic degeneration, and mechanical impingement in the space available for the biceps tendon. Now, let's talk about the etiology of distal biceps avulsions. So with respect to pathophysiology, the mechanism involves excessive eccentric tension as the arm is forced from a flexed to an extended position, which is otherwise known as a flexed elbow unacceptably challenged. The mechanism of a distal biceps avulsion also has to do with the fact that the distal biceps is technically in a vascular watershed area, and the mechanism can also be related to mechanical attrition, such as abrasion during pronosupination. As far as associated conditions with distal biceps avulsions, rarely it can lead to symptoms of median nerve compression. Now, let's go over some relevant anatomy. So the biceps tendon inserts onto the radial tuberosity. In terms of the contents of the antecubital fossa from medial to lateral, know that the median nerve is the most medial structure, then the brachial artery, then the biceps tendon, and the radial nerve is the most lateral structure. Know that the radial recurrent vessels lie superficial to the biceps tendon. The distal biceps tendon possesses two distinct insertions. The short head attaches distally on the radial tuberosity, which is a thin sliver, and then the long head attaches proximally on the radial tuberosity, and this is known as the oval footprint. So as far as the short head attaching distally on the radial tuberosity, again, this is a thin sliver, the origin is the coracoid process, and know that this is a better flexor. As far as the long head attaching proximally on the radial tuberosity or the oval footprint, know that the origin is the superior lip of the glenoid and the glenoid labrum. The long head is a better supinator as the attachment is furthest from the axis of rotation, and know that it attaches to the apex of the radial tuberosity. The long head of the biceps has an independent function to prevent anterior, inferior, and superior translation of the humeral head against the proximal pull of the short head of the biceps. Now, let's quickly talk about the Lacerda's fibrosis. So distal to the elbow crease, the tendon gives off from its medial side the Lacerda's fibrosis, which is the bicipital aponeurosis or the biceps fascia. It originates from the distal short head of the biceps tendon. The Lacerda's passes obliquely across the cubital fossa, running distally and medially, helping to protect the underlying brachial artery and median nerve. It is continuous with the deep fascia of the flexor tendon origin and envelops the flexor muscle bellies. Remember that it may be mistaken for an intact distal biceps tendon on clinical exam. Moving on to the presentation of a distal biceps avulsion, the patient may often give a history of experiencing a painful pop as the elbow is eccentrically loaded from flexion to extension. Symptoms include weakness and pain, primarily in supination, which are all hallmarks of the injury. Moving on to physical exam, inspection and palpation may reveal varying degrees of proximal retraction of the muscle belly. This is known as a reverse Popeye sign. You may see change in the contour of the muscles proximally, medial ecchymosis, and know that a palpable defect is often appreciated. On motor exam in the setting of distal biceps avulsions, know that there is loss of more supination than flexion strength. Specifically, there will be loss of 50% sustained supination strength, loss of 40% supination strength in general, and loss of 30% flexion strength. Provocative tests in the setting of a distal biceps avulsion includes a hook test and a Roulant bicep squeeze test, which is akin to the Thompson/Simmons test for Achilles rupture. So a hook test is performed by asking the patient to actively flex the elbow to 90 degrees and to fully supinate the forearm. The examiner then uses the index finger to hook the lateral edge of the biceps tendon. With an intact/partially torn tendon, the finger can be inserted 1 centimeter beneath the tendon. You can have a false positive with a hook test in the setting of a partial tear, an intact Lacerda's fibrosis, or an underlying brachialis tendon. Know that the sensitivity and specificity of a hook test is generally regarded as 100%. Moving on to the Roulant bicep squeeze test, which is akin to the Thompson-Simmons test for Achilles rupture, the elbow is held in 60 to 80 degrees of flexion with the forearm slightly pronated, and then one hand stabilizes the elbow while the other hand squeezes across the distal biceps muscle belly. A positive test is failure to observe supination of the patient's forearm or wrist. This has a sensitivity of 96%. Know that the challenge is to distinguish between a complete tear and a partial tear. Know that the biceps tendon is absent in complete ruptures and palpable in partial ruptures. Otherwise, they have a very similar clinical picture. Moving on to the evaluation of distal biceps avulsions, radiographs are usually normal, however, occasionally show a small fleck or avulsion of bone from the radial tuberosity. An MRI is the diagnostic study of choice, and know that positioning in elbow flexion, shoulder abduction, and forearm supination increases sensitivity. It's important to distinguish between a complete tear versus a partial tear, muscle substance versus tendon tear, and the degree of retraction. Moving on to the treatment of distal biceps avulsion, this can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative options include supportive treatment followed by physical therapy, and this is indicated in older, low-demand, or sedentary patients who are willing to sacrifice function, and it can also be indicated if the Lacerda's fibrosis is intact, as the functional deficits of the biceps rupture may be minimized in a low-demand patient. As far as the outcomes of non-operative management in the setting of a distal biceps avulsion, know that patients will lose 50% sustained supination strength, they will lose 40% supination strength overall, will lose 30% flexion strength, and will lose 15% grip strength. Operative options for distal biceps avulsions include surgical repair of the tendon to the tuberosity. Indications include young, healthy patients who do not want to sacrifice function, partial tears that do not respond to non-operative management, subacute/chronic ruptures may be treated successfully with direct repair without allograft, however you may need to hyperflex the elbow to achieve fixation. Note that hyperflexion does not lead to loss of elbow range of motion or flexion contracture. As far as timing of surgery, note that surgical treatment should occur within a few weeks from the date of injury. Note that further delay may preclude a straightforward primary repair, and a more extensile approach may be required in a chronic rupture to retrieve the retracted and scarred distal biceps tendon. Now, let's talk about some of the surgical techniques for a distal biceps avulsion in a bit more detail. Know that the single incision technique was developed to reduce the incidence of heterotopic ossification and synostosis seen with the double incision technique. So the technique involves a limited antecubital fossa incision. It uses the interval between the brachioradialis and the pronator teres. You will perform a radial or lateral retraction of the brachioradialis and medial retraction of the pronator teres. Then the lateral antebrachial cutaneous nerve is identified as it exits between the biceps and brachialis at the antecubital fossa. You will then have recurrent radial vessels encountered and either coagulated or carefully dissected and retracted. And then finally, you'll protect the PIN by limiting forceful lateral retraction and maintaining supination. Complications of the anterior single incision technique includes injury to the lateral antebrachial cutaneous nerve, which is the most common, and keep in mind that you will have more lateral antebrachial cutaneous nerve injury than in a two-incision approach. Another potential complication of the anterior single incision technique is radial nerve or PIN injury, which is the most severe complication. However, the risk has decreased with new tendon fixation techniques that require less dissection in the antecubital fossa. Another potential complication is synostosis and resulting loss of pronation/supination. Be sure to avoid exposing the periosteum of the ulna and avoid dissection between the radius and the ulna. Finally, heterotopic ossification is another potential complication. However, this is less common than with the two-incision technique. Postoperatively, these patients should be immobilized in 110 degrees of flexion and moderate supination. Moving on to a dual-incision technique, this has been developed to avoid injury to the radial nerve/PIN. The technique uses a smaller anterior incision over the antecubital fossa and a second posterolateral elbow incision. Know that the posterior interval is between the ECU and the EDC. Be sure to avoid exposing the ulna. And be sure that you do not use the interval between the ECU slash Anconius, which is the Kolker's interval, or the Anconius and the ulna. Next, anterior dissection will be the same as in the single incision technique that we previously described. After the biceps is identified, the radial tuberosity is palpated, and a blunt, curved hemostat is placed in the interosseous space along the medial border of the tuberosity and palpated on the dorsal proximal forearm. The hemostat pierces the Anconius and tents the skin, indicating where the posterolateral incision should be made. As far as complications of the dual incision technique, lateral antibrachial cutaneous nerve injury is the most common, and synostosis and heterotopic ossification are more common with a two-incision technique than a single-incision technique. As far as distal biceps fixation techniques, let's start with some quick comparison of load tolerances of the distal biceps. So with the elbow at 90 degrees and no load, the distal biceps sustains 50 newtons. With the elbow at 90 degrees with 1 kilogram of load, the distal bicep sustains 112 newtons, and the force to rupture will equal 200 newtons, and know that the repair needs to be able to withstand 50 newtons. Suture button fixation can tolerate 400 newtons of force. Suture anchor fixation tolerates 380 newtons of force. The bone tunnel technique tolerates 310 newtons of force, and an interference screw tolerates 230 newtons of force. Know that a combination technique, that is a suture button plus an interference screw, will be stronger than a single technique. Now let's talk about creating the bone tunnels. So this will be done with the two-incision approach, where the tuberosity is exposed and a guide pin is drilled through the center of the tuberosity. An acorn reamer is used to ream through the anterior cortex to recreate a slot of varying depth. Two or three 2 millimeter diameter holes are drilled 1 centimeter apart through the lateral far side of the radius. Know that number 2 sutures sewn to the distal tendon are passed and tied across the bone bridge. As far as suture anchors, these can be placed with a single incision approach. Know that the radial tuberosity will be debrided to prepare for bone to tendon healing. 2 suture anchors are then inserted into the biceps tuberosity, 1 distal and 1 proximal. The distal suture anchor is tied first to bring the tendon out to length. Next, the sutures of the proximal anchor are tied. This repair sequence maximizes tendon to bone contact and surface area. In terms of intraosseous screw fixation, this can also be done with a single incision approach. This is similar to the bone tunnel technique, except the number 2 suture is whip stitched through the tendon and then is passed through a bioabsorbable tenodesis screw. Finally, let's quickly talk about a suspensory cortical button, which is also done with a single incision approach. The tendon end is whip stitched with the suture ends placed into 2 central holes of the button. Similar to the bone tunnel technique, an acorn reamer is used to ream through the anterior cortex after exposing the tuberosity. A smaller hole is then drilled through the far cortex to allow the button to be passed across the far cortex. The button is flipped to lie on the far cortex and the suture ends are tensioned, otherwise known as a tension slide, to bring the tendon into the tunnel. Now let's end this review session talking about some complications. So lateral antibrachial cutaneous nerve injury, as we previously mentioned, is the most common complication overall with a 9% incidence. This complication is typically because of overaggressive retraction. Know that it's more common with a single incision technique. However, it usually resolves in 3 to 6 months. PIN injury is more common in a single incision than a two incision technique. And know that this is the most commonly injured motor nerve with a 1 to 2% incidence. This usually resolves in 3 to 6 months. Superficial radial nerve injury is the second most common cutaneous nerve injured with a 2 to 3% incidence. Heterotopic ossification is another potential complication, and this can happen if the interosseous membrane and the ulnar periosteum is disrupted. This is also more of a risk of the two-incision technique. Another potential complication is synostosis. Proximal radius fracture can occur from large tunnels, and suture rupture can happen if the bone tunnel method is used. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. First question. A 28-year-old medical student presents to your office after a weightlifting injury. He was in the middle of a lift when he felt a pop and immediate pain near his left elbow. Exam shows ecchymosis over the volar arm, painful elbow motion, and weakness with resisted forearm supination. In-office ultrasound confirms your diagnosis, and based on this, you recommend surgical repair. What nearby vascular structure is most at risk when using a volar approach? And the choices are 1, anterior interosseous artery, 2, anterior recurrent ulnar artery, 3, recurrent radial artery, 4, recurrent interosseous artery, and 5, ulnar artery. The correct answer to this question is 3, recurrent radial artery. So this patient has a classic history and exam for a ruptured distal biceps tendon. During the volar approach, the recurrent radial artery is encountered crossing near the biceps tuberosity and is often ligated during the procedure. To quickly review, distal biceps ruptures are common athletic injuries frequently occurring during eccentric muscle contraction. The biceps' primary function is to supinate the forearm with lesser contributions to elbow flexion. Though non-operative treatment is sometimes tolerated in less active individuals, most require surgical repair or, in chronic cases, tendinous reconstruction. With the volar antecubital approach, the lateral antibrachial cutaneous nerve is immediately encountered, exiting laterally between the biceps and brachialis muscles. During the deep dissection, the recurrent radial artery is found near the tuberosity. This should either be dissected and carefully retracted from the field or ligated to prevent disruption and hematoma formation. The posterior interosseous nerve is located more lateral and dorsal at this level, and avoiding forceful retraction limits the risk of injury. Sutton et al. Provided an overview on distal biceps rupture management. They discussed the advantages and disadvantages of single or dual incision techniques and the various fixation devices available for repair. They concluded both techniques are safe and effective, but the surgeon should be mindful of the pertinent nearby neurovascular structures. Lin et al. Reviewed the clinical utility of ultrasound in the upper extremity. Though the ultrasound is user-dependent, it is immediately available at the point of care and can aid in both diagnosing common tendinopathies and for injection guidance. Given these benefits, they advocated for the implementation of ultrasound into the orthopedic residency curriculum. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, the anterior interosseous artery branches from the ulnar artery and courses along the interosseous membrane. Answer 2, the anterior recurrent artery branches from the ulnar artery and courses proximal and superficial to the brachialis insertion. Answer 4, the recurrent interosseous artery branches from the posterior interosseous and is located in the posterior forearm. And finally, answer 5, the ulnar artery is far medial to the biceps tuberosity and runs between the FDS and FDP muscle bellies. And moving on to the final question, a 42-year-old male presents to the ED after injuring his right arm while moving a solid wood dresser. He reports trying to put the dresser down when it slipped, forcing his arm into extension. He then heard a pop and had pain and weakness in his right arm. On examination, he has mild swelling about the antecubital fossa, prominence of the biceps muscle belly, and an abnormal hook test. Which of the following properly describes the mechanism of contraction that most commonly leads to this patient's pathology? And the choices are 1, muscle contracts with constant length, 2, muscle contracts with constant speed, 3, muscle contracts with constant force, 4, muscle shortens during contraction, and 5, muscle lengthens during contraction. The correct answer to this question is 5, muscle lengthens during contraction. So distal biceps ruptures most commonly occur following excessive eccentric contraction. Typically, the biceps muscle lengthens during contraction as the arm is forced from a flex to an extended position. To quickly review, ruptures of the distal biceps are relatively rare and account for 10% of all biceps ruptures. Most commonly, these injuries occur during eccentric contraction and in the dominant elbow of male patients in their 40s. Most patients are able to give a history of a painful pop followed by weakness and supination. On exam, patients may have a reverse Popeye sign in which the retracted biceps muscle belly is prominent in the upper arm. Additionally, patients may have a positive hook test in which the examiner is unable to hook the lateral aspect of the biceps tendon, hooking from lateral to medial. Several techniques exist for repair, including 1 and 2 incision approaches and various fixation methods, such as bone tunnels, suture anchors, intraosseous screw fixation, intramedullary buttons, and suspensory cortical buttons. Bison et al. Reviewed complications associated with the modified 2-incision technique for repair of distal biceps ruptures. They report a complication rate of 27% on 45 consecutive cases, including nerve dysfunction with an N of 7, radial ulnar synostosis with an N of 3, loss of motion unrelated to heterotopic ossification with an N of 2, early re-rupture with an N of 1, and reflex sympathetic dystrophy with an N of 1. They conclude that functional synostosis occurred more frequently in their series than previously reported. Cusick et al. Reviewed the incidence of tendon re-rupture following distal biceps repair using a cortical button and interference screw. They report an early failure rate of 1.2% with only 2 patients having failure of fixation. They conclude that the use of cortical suspensory fixation in conjunction with an interference screw is an effective method of repairing a distal biceps rupture with a low early failure rate. Watson et al. Reviewed the various repair techniques and complication rates for distal biceps repairs. They report an overall complication rate of 24.5%. This rate did not differ significantly between one or two incision techniques. However, bone tunnel and cortical button fixation methods have significantly lower complication rates than did suture anchor and interosseous screws. They conclude that future studies should be performed to determine the optimal number of incisions. O'Driscoll et al. Reviewed the hook test for distal biceps tendon avulsions. They report on the accuracy of the hook test performed by a single examiner on 45 patients who are undergoing surgical exploration of the distal biceps tendon. 100% of patients with an N of 33 with a complete avulsion had an abnormal hook test, whereas it was intact in the 12 remaining patients with only a partial tear. MRI diagnosed a complete tear in 11 of 12 patients with partial tears and 11 of 13 with complete avulsions. They conclude that the hook test is both highly sensitive and specific for distal biceps tendon avulsions. Amara Surya et al. Performed a systematic review of the complications following distal biceps tendon repair. They report an overall complication rate of 25% with an N of 774, with major complications occurring in 4.6% with an N of 114, including PIN injury in 1.6% of patients. They conclude that an extensile single incision was associated with a higher rate of superficial radial nerve injury, which was a minor complication, compared with the limited single incision. Furthermore, synostosis occurred only after double incision techniques. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, muscle contracts with constant length is incorrect as this describes an isometric contraction, which is one in which the muscle contracts with a constant length and is not associated with distal biceps ruptures. Answer 2, muscle contracts with constant speed is incorrect as this describes isokinetic contractions, which occur with constant speed and are not associated with distal biceps ruptures. Answer 3, muscle contracts with constant force is incorrect, as this describes isotonic contractions, which occur with constant force and are not associated with distal biceps ruptures. Finally, answer 4, muscle shortens during contraction is incorrect, as this describes concentric contractions, which occur when the muscle is shortened during contraction, as occurs during a biceps curl, and are not highly associated with rupture. That's all for this review about distal biceps avulsion. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow, right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.